Hey, this is continuing with Ken Kellerman and Harry Vonderlaan.
Maybe you needed a wider range of frequencies in a factor of two. And so I asked, and Cambridge had been, you know, doing all these low frequency surveys and everything. So I asked Graham about the availability of the low frequency data. And it turns out that some hours before that, Robin Conway had been doing spectra work at 220 and 400 megahertz or something at Jodl Bank, and also asked him about this. And in the course of conversation, it was thought that if we could put all this stuff together, it might be very useful. And it was Bob Long who was...
That's right.
Bob Long also was working on the Cambridge low-frequency spectral data at the time.
What was it, 38 and 81
megahertz? Yep. And he took the survey data to work on a spectra. So for about a year, I guess, we corresponded on things and, you know, sent data back and forth and everything. And then I went over there in the spring of 62.
So this is why you're still working on your thesis?
Yeah, you spent a few months at Cambridge where we actually put it together.
Still before you had your degree?
Yeah.
Okay, so
I met Harry.
That's where you got to Cambridge, so let's go back to you. You were in Cambridge earlier.
No, I went to Cambridge in 1960. This is really, I think it's amusing, not historically, but maybe for you to know how I got into radio astronomy, because I did grammar school in Holland, and then my parents immigrated when I was 16, and I went along with them, of course, with the whole family. And I worked for a couple of years and learned English at night and so forth. I went to high school in grade 13 in Ontario. That's the fifth high school year. I went to university into math and physics, and graduated with honors, got a gold medal, and got a, what's it called? One of these things, a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship to go to Stanford to do theoretical physics. But Diane and I said it would be sort of nice to live in Europe for a while. And I said, okay, I'll apply for some fellowship or scholarship in Britain. So I applied for a Commonwealth scholarship, which was just for the first year. It was a Commonwealth program just established. And I remember how laborious it was to fill out those forms. It was in quadruplicates.
Mm. You almost said the hell.
I almost said, right. Oh, forget it. You know, but I went through with it, getting references and writing sort of what you'd done and what you might do, and I had no idea. So I just applied for a fellowship to do mathematical physics in Cambridge. I had no idea what it might entail. So lo and behold, we'd already rented an apartment in Palo Alto. And I got this thing to go to England. And they said, you can go and do mathematical physics at Cambridge and you'll be a member of Pembroke College. So, a research student at Pembroke College. So I arrived in Cambridge and I had no idea what to do. So for 6 weeks, I shopped around and I really met some people with impressive names. A Professor Frisch in nuclear physics and Balkinghorn in high energy physics. And G.I. Taylor, the grand old man of fluid mechanics, and Batchelor and Mestel in DAMTP.
So you had to get to one of these people to agree to take you on still?
Yes, and I had to be, in fact, it turns out there must have been a shortage of research students or something, but I could have worked with any one of those groups as a research student. Apparently with the qualifications I had, with the fellowship, I didn't need any money, I just needed an interesting project. And so I went to a lot of lectures and I talked to other research students who were there. I talked to each one of these and I made appointments, and Ryle was my last appointment. No, I hadn't had G.I. Taylor, he wasn't there. I'd had all the others and talked to them personally as a sort of a naive student. And I had an appointment with Ryle, and then one day I walked into Ryle's office and into his secretary's office, and they have connecting doors, Molly, she's still the secretary. I said, I have an appointment with Dr. Ryle. And Molly looks at me and she says, Professor Ryle, you mean?
No, no, Mr. Ryle. He was a professor then, was he?
No, he was.
No, he wasn't.
Yes, he was.
No.
In 1960, he was.
Was he?
Yes, you mean Professor Ryle. He wasn't a doctor.
Yeah.
And of course, I did never know that made any difference. But anyway, he doesn't have a PhD, of course. None of those people have. Tommy Gold and Fred Hoyle don't have a PhD either. I think it was fashionable in Cambridge,
that's
as
right.
soon as you got a college fellowship, to withdraw your candidacy from a PhD.
So well, the war also that affected
yes.
those people.
Yeah.
By the time the war was
PhD
over,
is much considered inferior to a fellowship at Trinity or at King's or something like that. Because if you have a global outlook, then you know you need a PhD as a bread and butter ticket. But those days, that was not important. Anyway, I walk into Ryle's office and he sort of looks me over, and he didn't have any of my records, no transcript. He says, so, okay, come on, tell me about it. Because I had honestly never even heard of Ryle or of radio astronomy in Cambridge. I was completely naive. I'd always done mathematics and physics as an undergraduate. I didn't have the vaguest notion. But so Ross said, okay, so you're looking for something to do, huh? Yes, and how long will your fellowship last? I said, at least 3 years. He says, okay. He says, well, we've got this problem. He said, sit down. And he had a blackboard in his office. He still has the same office, so they've now moved. And he started drawing supernova remnants. I had heard about supernova. I had never heard about a supernova remnant. And he says, these things emit radio emission. And he says, we don't know why, and we don't know how, and we want to know about it. And he says, if you're interested in mathematical physics or theoretical physics, this is a good theoretical problem. And he says, the last room at the end of the corridor has an empty desk, so why don't you go ahead and start? And I said, well, tell me a little more about these things. And so he did, sort of in a vague way, but I thought his enthusiasm was so contagious. And with all the other people I talked to, they were interested and interesting, but they didn't convey something that was engaging or enthusiastic. I mean, Ryle was just enthusiastic in a childlike way. He was exuberant about the stuff. And that really took me on, and I went home that night, and so I said to Diane, well, I met this interesting man, Professor Ryle, and he's talking about crazy problems, and he says, I can start right away, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know whether I can ever do it, but it sounds fascinating, and I'm going to do it. And I did, and I remember I spent the first 2 months reading the Paris Symposium in Radio Astronomy, which was the only sort of overview. It was published in 1958. And I started to read a few other astrophysical, mostly IAU symposium reviews, and I started to go to the lectures by Leon Mestel called Cosmical Gas Dynamics, which is really a very good way to start. And that's how I got into radio astronomy. At that time, I was almost the only student who was doing, in quotation marks, theoretical work in the whole group. Peter Scheuer was a theoretician, but he was in Australia for 2.5 years. We only overlapped for a few months, Peter Scheuer and I. He overlapped enough that he was one of my PhD, that's what's called, examiners, he and Franz Kahn.
So your PhD thesis was on supernova remnant theory?
No, only the first half. I mean, I in 62 published 2 papers on supernova remnants that came out of that, and then I switched over to radio galaxies and quasar, or at least extragalactic source theory. I went to the Zeros Texas Symposium. Were you there, Ken?
No, I never.
No, Conway reported on the CKR papers. That was the symposium called the Physical Non-Thermal Radio Sources. In retrospect, that preceded by about 2 months the recognition of the 3C48 spectrum as being a highly redshifted one.
And when was that now?
That was in December, just before Christmas, 1962.
And where?
In New York, at Jastrow's Institute in Riverside Drive.
Right. Are there any proceedings from this conference?
Yeah.
Yes, there is.
It's called the Physics of Non-Thermal Radio Sources.
Oh, that's what that is.
Yes, that's what that is.
Yeah.
Sciama, for example, gave the paper from Sciama and Berman. And Greenstein was there, and Martin Schmidt, and they had very peculiar papers on explaining what were now quasar spectra in terms of white dwarfs.
Hey. You've got to try it. There's a preprint of this paper floating around. No, you've got to try to get a hold of that.
It's not published.
That's right.
They withdrew the paper.
I've got it somewhere. I don't know if I could ever find it again. There's all these lines at 3C48, which they identify with all these exotic, multiply ionized things and whatnot. And just about to send it in was the breakthrough.
Yeah, if you should find it, send me a copy, please.
I had written Mark Schmidt before I went to that conference and say, look, what I need
they burnt
now,
all the copies that they know of.
I had a kind of theory, you know, which was just, we knew then from Moffat and Maupy's work that radio sources were tended to be doubled. We'd no idea how confined they were, and I was trying to develop a theory of having spherical explosions where the duplicity came in as a kind of limb brightening due to expansion into a cylindrically symmetric intergalactic magnetic field. And I worked that out, and I published that in 2 papers on monthly notices in 63. Those 4 papers constituted my thesis, plus the last chapter, which deals with radio sources in clusters in 1963, which I didn't publish at the time.
Let me ask you both a question about those days at Cambridge. That's when log N, log S was just getting resolved, it seems to me.
I don't know if it's been resolved.
Well, at least the Mills, Ryle.
That's when the Ryle and Clark paper.
Discrepancy. With the Parkes antenna hadn't come along quite
yet.
Right.
Yeah. That's right.
And that was perhaps the final thing that did it. But what was the situation, I mean, as you saw it? Was it really sort of a fort, you know, where you were constantly firing saddles, or was everyone sort of just concerned to work it out and they didn't care?
That was actually, a minimum at the time. See, it reached a peak around 1960 between the Cambridge and Australian stuff.
By the time I got there, had been fought.
Yeah, that's right. And
they were no longer speaking terms.
And then it did really come back up again. Until Parkes got going.
Well, except that there was, I mean, there
didn't really
was
back
a,
up until the late
was
60s.
A major announcement with a lot of press coverage and a Royal Astronomical Society meeting devoted to it.
Right.
where Ryle announced the results. These must have been the results using the 4C antennas.
That's right, that's right.
And from that result of the Ryle and Clark paper.
That's right.
Rupert Clark.
That's right.
This was just the first part of the 4C, which confirmed the 3C P of D, something like this, if I remember correctly.
Yes, I think you're right. I think it was all already in the 3C P of D. But
that's
it
right.
Does extend things, yes, quite a lot deeper than 3C, of
course. Yeah.
And because I remember, first of all, there was an RES meeting, there was a press conference and an RES meeting, and I remember Hoyle and Nardekar immediately started to try to contrive a steady-state cosmology with locally Hubble, quasi-Hubble expansion, expanding regions so that you could sort of save the steady state.
So this was sort of a local minimum in the controversy when you were there?
In 60, 61, they were, 61, 62 were pretty quiet. I thought it was in 62, it may have been 63 that this announcement was in the Clark-Ryle paper.
Which stirred it up
submitted,
again.
Was submitted, which stirred it up quite a bit. I always had the feeling that, I think in that sense, you know, steady state made a big contribution because it was a great stimulus. It was not so much, if you like, a cosmological theory in the sense of a full-fledged theory that was being tested, but it was really a test simply of the perfect cosmological principle.
Right, well, it made a definite prediction, which none of the others did. Right.
Well, but the theory, I mean, you don't even need the theory for that. It's just the hypothesis of the perfect cosmological
principle. That's true.
Is the whole thing.
It was unique.
Forget everything about geometry.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what made it so vulnerable, of course, also.
Yes.
The other
that
people
made
can always
a great
weasel
stimulus.
Out.
It wasn't some terribly subtle effect. It was a terribly clear-cut thing. And I remember how pleased Ryle was when he got Oort's preprint. Well, he had very mixed feelings. Oort gave a preprint at a symposium in Paris called Large Antennas,
something
like
that.
Yeah, the OECD.
And Oort there called that effect the Ryle effect. And Oort was one of the first really prestigious astronomers who completely accepted his first order interpretation of his radio source counts, called it the Ryle effect, and worked it out. And I remember he said, because I walked into his office when he just got the paper that day, and he looked at it, and he said to Rupert Clark and me, he says, "Look, Rupert, we could have written that paper, damn it." He said, you know, but he thought it was great. At the same time, he said, he was right, of course. They could have written that paper if they'd had the time.
Had to do with luminosity functions.
That's right.
Right.
There were enough identifications then to try to extrapolate it, to actually get the proper volume density ratio,
right.
Which they hadn't done.
Now, what about your CKO? Was that just sort of a straightforward putting together?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, things just fell right in. I was actually going to go back a bit. I could tell you the exact same story about how I got into radio astronomy. All you have to do is substitute Bolton for Ryle.
Really?
and observational radio astronomy, theoretical. It's ironic. I mean, you won't believe it now. We should have done this independently.
Yes.
But I had worked in high energy physics as an undergraduate at MIT. And I went to Caltech intending to do high energy physics at the synchrotron there. I had an assistantship, which meant I was supposed to work 15 hours a week on some research project. And I also was given some weeks to go around and talk to people. And I talked. I always had a background interest in astronomy. It never occurred to me that you could actually do this professionally for a living or anything.
Yeah.
But cosmic rays sounded more proper.
Yes.
And I talked to cosmic ray people and the synchrotron, of course. And it was obvious that synchrotron was a loser from the beginning. I mean, there were guys there 6-7 years all doing the same thing, each one bouncing
that was
nucleus off some other nucleus.
Bubble chamber track analysis,
right.
It seemed to the worms.
And I talked to a number of people about low temperature physics and everything, and the last one on the list was, they told me that this guy Bolton was doing radio astronomy. He's looking for students, might be worth talking to. And it's the exact same situation. I went in and there was a secretary sitting there. And I asked to speak to Dr. Bolton.
Incredible.
And I was told,
"Mr. Bolton? That's
Mr. Bolton over there." And he was right there. And he turned around and said, "What do you want?" Very abrupt.
And you didn't know what you were doing.
And I knew as much about radio astronomy as you did, Harry.
Right.
And I sort of said I was sort of interested in this or something. And he only asked me two questions. One, what I know about electronics. I told him I was a radio ham. And I worked one summer in a microwave laboratory or something. And the other question was how I felt about heights. And what I thought he was referring to was the fact that the observatory was up at an elevation of 4,000 feet. Would that bother me?
Right.
So I said, "Oh no, it doesn't bother me at all." What he really meant was, how do you feel about climbing around an antenna?
Yes, right.
And that was all he needed to know. And the same thing, he said, "Well, there's an office down the hall you can use."
Incredible.
And,
well, actually, I've heard several similar stories, not in these details that are so remarkably similar, but people just blundering in. It seems almost that very few people actually started off always wanting to be astronomers and then looked at this radio astronomy, you know, and conscientiously said, this is the way to go.
Right. Yeah, I had to, you know, work 15 hours a week, and I, even at that time, I had no intention of doing it for a thesis.
I see.
But I had to satisfy my assistantship, and even after this brief interview, all the other people had said, well, you know, think about it and come back. And it was a gentlemanly way out for both, you know, to say, well, I'd like to go and look at your record and whatnot and see if I really want you.
Yeah.
And but he didn't care. He'd never seen or heard of me. He didn't care. So if you were physically able and you could dig ditches and plant trees and climb my antennas, you were acceptable.
Hmm.
Well, I guess there was a cutoff level since you were a Caltech graduate student.
Yeah.
You had some capability or something. And and he's just too forceful and domineering to say, I'd like to think about it. Okay.
Do either of you know if this was the standard technique with other students also?
Oh, it was, well...
At Cambridge, most research students were undergraduates at Cambridge. Mm-hmm.
So they knew
they would
before.
Have had a course, they would have had, say, a physics lab that was demonstrated by one of Ryle's people, say, John Baldwin.
Yeah.
So they'd know a great deal more about
right.
it. There were very few people from outside. Although Canadians were fairly prominent among the outsiders, you know, people like John Galt and Alan Bridle, but also the
Carmen Costain.
Carmen Costain,
right. Yeah, I talked to him.
And younger people, yes, like Alan Bridle and Chris Purton, he was there, overlapped with me. So I don't know why that was. I think it's because once you have one contact who goes back to that country, he will send students over there.
Yeah, probably.
But at Caltech, the project was just starting, and they needed people, and... you know, sort of all students were welcome. He did, as I recall, they did have a... I was in the physics department then. I was a graduate student in physics. And, you know, Bolton did prefer physicists over astronomers.
Yeah. Now, did you do anything else in Cambridge besides the spectrum?
No, I was just there that few months where we were just putting stuff together. Right.
So when you got back...
It was fun, though.
Oh, yeah, right. I mean,
because
I saw Harry a lot.
Across the corridor from
right.
me. And Bob Long's office, and he'd come in and have an idea, and we'd try to shut it down.
The most...
often did, but it was a lot of interesting interaction.
I mean, out of that came the first sources with, the classical source all had, you know, quasi-Powell law spectrum and everything.
Right.
And there were these two sources that had been found by accident at Caltech, CTA-21 and CTA-102. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've talked to Dan Harris yet, the accident. I mean,
no,
in
I
the paper it says that they were picked up. It was this Harris and Roberts study of three C sources. They did RA and DIC scans around three C sources, and the paper that says that, you know, CTA, these few CTA sources were picked up during these scans. Well, if you look carefully, you'll see that CTA 21 or something is, you know, is about 5 degrees away from 3C86. I think it was Dan fell asleep because he'd been out drinking that night or something. And they let the telescope run for half an hour.
I see.
And ran across this source. And the unfortunately, that wasn't... I mean, there were these two or three that were found, and it was noted...
With inverted spectra, you're saying?
Well, no, all it was... at that time, it was just noted as previously uncatalogued sources. And it was sort of...
comparable to the 3C one.
Yeah, it was sort of subconsciously assumed that there was in a 3C side lobe or something like this, where they pen recorded didn't work or something. Nobody got very excited about it. And when I went to Cambridge, we actually looked back on the 4C records. I mean, and there they were.
Yeah.
They weren't strong enough to have been cataloged, but they were there, and strong enough to pick out and get the flux. And indeed, you saw that the inverted spectra. And
the first thing they looked like thermal spectra.
Well, no, we didn't interpret it that way, but they were consistent. CTA-21 and CTA-102 were consistent with a spectrum of monoenergetic electrons. In other words, it was just a gradual roll-off at the low end, and it wasn't enough to require self-absorption. And then there were these other five or six or so, like Cygnus A at 295, which had clear curvature. And there was also the clear relation, and we put this in a separate note in Nature, of the relation between the curvature and the surface brightness.
Mm-hmm.
And the high surface brightness sources had the curvature.
I remember that.
But we missed the interpretation. I mean, it was a simple-minded interpretation that the high surface brightness sources were younger and therefore they had higher magnetic fields, and therefore you had the electron decay, which is not unreasonable, but that wasn't the right answer.
They were compact. Well, younger, compact.
Compact, yeah, but we didn't realize that they were so compact that they'd have to have self-absorption.
But that was the paper in which you got Conway's students as co-author. There was some friction,
right,
wasn't there? I mean, the Jodrell Bank wanted a big share in the credit. How was that finally resolved, anyway?
Well, that's part of the reason why there were the two papers.
Why there was the Nietzsche paper as well, yes.
Yeah. But straighten me out, I'm not clear on this point. How was your set of spectra in CKL superior to, I guess Whitfield was the standard before that? Is that correct?
That's right. It was just another 5 years later data. I mean, the data was more accurate. I think Whitfield only went up to 850. His high frequency was a 3C catalog.
Oh, I see.
We went up to 20 and some sources even in 10 centimeters.
Right. Did it appreciably change the... state of affairs, though? I mean, you just sort of extrapolated, really.
It established
it more reliably.
It established more clearly that all the sources had this narrow dispersion spectral index, that some of them, at least, didn't have power law spectra, that it was particularly the high surface brightness ones, and that there were these few odd cases. And we missed the boat in following up. The fact that these two were discovered by accident should have indicated to do a proper survey.
Well, it's easy to say in retrospect.
Yeah. And I finally did, just before I left, do this 21 centimeter survey, which was the so-called CTD survey. But it wasn't enough of the sky to get any statistics.
Okay, let's take you back to Caltech then. And you were there until when, 60?
I finished in 63.
Right, but you stayed at Caltech a while?
No, just for that summer. Then I went to Australia on a postdoctoral fellowship.
Oh, I see. So you weren't around for the quasar.
That came in 62.
That's right.
Early 63. It was spring of
February 63.
That's right.
We got the telex or something from Caltech. That went through the grapevine very quickly.
Yeah.
In a day or two.
Right.
All around the globe.
And what did that mean as far as what was to run out to the telescope and do? The recognition of the high redshifts, I mean, what did it immediately suggest that you should do observationally?
Well, I mean, the whole program at Caltech was centered around the identifications and the collaboration between the radio and the optical people.
So in that sense, it proved eminently successful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a classic case of setting out a long-range program and just stepping along. The first 50 or so accurate positions led to a reasonable number of identifications, ultimately 3C2. The idea was that the small sources would be the ones whose position you could measure most accurately. They were high surface brightness, and therefore they might be associated with very powerful and distant galaxies. And there was the beginning of the ideas at that time that the radio galaxies were not normal galaxies, but had emission lines, and therefore you could measure their redshifts at larger distance than if they didn't have the emission lines. So there was this push to identify small diameter radio sources in the hopes that they might be very distant galaxies. And this just went on and on until we got to 295. And then, very soon after 295, was the 3C48 and then 286, I think, which were identified with these stellar objects. And these papers were written interpreting their spectra. And then, I don't know if you know the story on 273, because that's a little bit lost in the literature. It should have been identified much earlier. I mean, it's the 10th brightest source or the 6th brightest source in the 3C catalog, and it's in a completely clear field. I mean, there's nothing else optically nearby.
Yeah.
There was a clerical position in the Caltech Right Ascension, which missed the identification coming in Caltech. It was, because it was one of the brightest unidentified sources at Parkes, because it was one of the brightest unidentified sources, it was one that John Bolton immediately got onto. He measured a position just with the Parkes telescope, just by doing RA and X scans, and got a position good enough to pick out this very bright 13th magnitude star.
Hmm.
The original identification was made on the basis of that, not the occultation.
I see.
And it was only because of that identification, with what appeared to be a bright star, that was all this effort made to do the occultation.
Right.
Well, I have talked to Hazard, and I think that's pretty much what he said.
Right,
also.
And I guess he told you about how they had a small part of the telescope to get the occultation.
I don't remember.
The first occultation was at an elevation of, some minutes of arc beyond the telescope.
They dug a hole in it.
No, they had to chop off a little girder or something to get it.
I didn't quite follow you when you said that.
But it's because they already had the tentative identification. They knew it was so
they really
important.
Wanted to pin down the size. Yeah. You said that it was missed at Caltech. Well, you mean when the Cambridge positions came in?
I don't know why it should have come out of the Cambridge positions even. I don't know why. Cambridge didn't have it because it's in a side lobe of M87. See, it's in the same right ascension as M87. And with these,
what's the M87 3C number?
274.
Yeah.
And with the survey instruments, it was very difficult to do because it has a big fan beam going south. But Caltech should have had it with the interferometer and just got lost in the mud or something.
Yeah.
But it was immediately confirmed, of course.
And did Schmidt also get the first spectrum of that, or who got the first spectrum?
I'm not sure who took the first spectrum.
Schmidt had two spectra right away, 3C84, and then he had another one to look at immediately, but I've forgotten which one that was.
I think it was 273.
3C48?
Yeah, so they were all... I mean, it was Schmidt.
Yeah, well,
Greenstein,
I'm going to get to Schmidt later.
Yeah, Bowen, we were all puzzling over this stuff.
Okay, let's move on. You went to Australia. What did you do there?
I went with the intention of carrying on the spectra work, both to do the Southern Hemisphere.
By then, Bolton had left and had gone to...
He left a year after I got there at Caltech. So he wasn't there during most of my thesis work, although he got me started. And I went there with the intention of carrying on both to do Southern Hemisphere sources and to push it higher in frequency. And I really didn't get what... there was also this... remember this question of the interpretation of the extended MSH sources, whether they're really extended sources or components of others.
Right.
It turned out that Peter Scheuer had studied a lot of these in Parkes. I spent a lot of time going through the...
They did some occultations from those things. Peter Scheuer, he did the occultation theory, you remember?
Yeah, right.
It was just single dish stuff, I think.
That's right. He did it with the Parkes telescope. Yeah. And I always spent a lot of time going through the original records just to get out spectral data. I didn't get much done during the first year. There were a lot of sources in the Parkes catalog that had apparently curved spectra, and I was trying to measure it more accurately by getting more accurate measurements at a number of frequencies. And it turned out a lot of them, when you got the accurate measurements, they were no longer curved. So it was sort of a negative result, not very interesting. And just sort of, it's an interesting thing. There's a sidelight. I moved up to Parkes from Sydney, and the general way of operation in Parkes was that the telescope during the daytime was reserved for maintenance.
Every
day from
40 hours?
From 8 to 2. And the only observations that were... But it wasn't really used for maintenance. I mean, days it was, but other days it would just sit there. And I'd ask to use it to do something. Well, we'd say, no, it's reserved for maintenance. And the only thing you're allowed to do in the daytime were those things that could only be done... It can only be done in the daytime. And that's the sun and Venus and Mercury. And so I put in a request to observe Mercury. And the telescope was just sitting there day after day.
Yeah.
And
That's how you got into the planetary stuff.
The very simple theory you had at the time, that Mercury didn't rotate, meant that you'd only be able to see it when you could see some of the sunlit side. And the big problem, of course, was being near the sun and side lobes and everything. And the optimum time to do it was clearly at greatest elongation, when it was half lit and you were far enough away from the sun. Well, now that I had every day to my disposal, I realized that this is the time to do it, when it was away from the sun. But it was still very weak. It would be very weak. And I had to average up a number of scans, and we didn't have computers and everything to do it. And we were able to digitize, take the data, and they had a scheme where the data could be digitized and the numbers printed out on an electric typewriter. And so every minute of arc or something, a number got printed on a typewriter. What I planned to do is scan back and forth. I get these big strips of numbers and then lay them down, glue them down all next to each other, and then just add up across to get my added scans. And I realized this is going to be a little bit tricky, and it was going to require some practice. So instead of waiting till greatest elongation, I decided to start right then and try and get all the bugs out of it. And the time when I was about to start was near inferior conjunction, where in fact the dark side was toward us, and there would be no chance of detecting it, but at least I could find out what the solar side looked like. And I did a couple of scans, and by God, there it was. The backside of Mercury, you know, as bright as anything.
Oh, was it brighter than you expected the front side even to be?
Well, it was the same. It was inferior conjunction, but it was close to the Earth. So the flux was large, whereas the expected flux elongation would have been a lot less. Now, the brightness temperature was about half of what you expected it to be. You expected the daytime side to be around 600, and you expected the nighttime side to be around zero. And I was observing the nighttime side was around 300.
Mm-hmm.
And then I followed it around for a rotation or so, and it stayed constant. It didn't change. And I missed my great discovery then. Good moral of this story is graduate students should learn to read foreign languages. Because there were two doctrines about Mercury. One was that it didn't rotate, and the other was it didn't have an atmosphere. And that's why the nighttime side had to be cold. Well, clearly one of those was wrong. Actually, there had been an earlier observation of Mercury taken at the greatest elongation in Michigan. And, they took the standard theory that said if the daytime side varies in the way that you expect from solar heating, and the nighttime side is zero, they took their observed value, which is about 400,
right,
and said if the backside is zero, then the front side's got to be 1100, mm-hmm, which is much too hot, and left it at that.
That was the first detection?
That was in Michigan, right, by Howard and Barrett and Haddock, I guess. And they didn't have the sensitivity to follow it around or anything.
So what did you miss?
Well, when I followed it around and saw that the temperature was constant all the way around, it meant that the nighttime side essentially was at the same temperature as the daytime side. There were only two explanations. One, that it really did rotate, yeah, and the other, that it had an atmosphere that could carry, like convection,
conductive,
carry the temperature around.
Or both, and, as we know now.
Well, no, there's not a significant atmosphere.
Well, that's, I guess, not for this problem.
But George Field had written a paper postulating an argon atmosphere that might be able to do this. And if you look through the literature, the evidence against no atmosphere, it was a lot weaker against the evidence for rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are statements all over the literature about, you know, the rotation being equal to the revolution by a part in 1,000 or a part in 10,000.
But that was based on late 19th century drawings.
Well, it was that was the trouble. It was all the secondary literature that I went to, reviews,
yeah,
and discussions and textbooks.
Yeah.
All the primary literature is in French by Schiaparelli and, mm-hmm, and these guys. Of course, I never went to that because I can't read French.
Yeah.
And it just got escalated. I mean, he wrote one paper and people copied that,
yeah,
and changed it and whatnot.
Made them a bit less hesitant, yes.
And it just got to be the doctrine. So I picked the wrong one of the two.
But what did you do, Ken?
I wrote the paper on
what did John Bolton say when you discussed it with him?
Oh, yeah. Well, we wrote the paper on the observational result.
I don't know that paper.
It's in Nature.
Yeah, but what does it say?
Well, we wrote the observational result.
You didn't draw
the temperature was. Yeah, and then the end said, you know, it could be due to a circulation of a thin atmosphere suggested by Field or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's even worse than that, I should have known, because actually, John was away then. He was traveling. And he was writing these letters back from everywhere he went.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote back from Arecibo that there's an anomaly in the ephemeris of the Arecibo radar data shows an anomaly in the ephemeris of Mercury. That's all he said. And even that should have been a clue for me to follow it up in that direction. I blew it.
But
that's how I got into planetary astronomy.
Are you referring now to the? Was it discovered that early from the radar?
Yeah,
Mercury's
radar. Right. It was within a few months
back
of that.
Back in 64 or something.
That's right.
I was thinking it was a bit later.
No, it was 64. In 64. It was in a few months of that. And then, of course, I mean, for a radio astronomer, you know, observing planets the same as observing radio sources, and the Parkes telescope was, you know, so much better than anything around that,
sure,
we were able to go and did Venus and Mars. Mars was a hot thing at the time.
No pun intended.
It's just the opposite. The year before, Rod Davies had come out with this hot temperature for Mars and postulated the Van Allen belts like on Jupiter. And there was a Mars probe going at that time, and
they almost, you know, called it back off the launching pad and put in some extra shielding and everything to protect against it. And so Mars was sort of topical at the time, and I did Mars, which is sort of the easiest or the best understood planet.
That gave what you were expecting.
Well, yeah, 200 degrees or what have you. And
so his observations were just mistaken somehow?
It was confusion, yeah.
Confusion.
And then Saturn was...
Were you working at a shorter wavelength than he was?
No, it was...
He was working at 21.
He was working at 21. I did 621 and 611 and 21. Okay. Mm-hmm. Venus even at 50 centimeters to get the long wavelength stuff. And then Saturn was also, I think Brian Cooper had earlier gotten a somewhat high temperature for Saturn at the longer wavelengths. So I continued that on to even longer wavelengths. And as we know now, in fact, that even though it's a thermal phenomenon, as you go to long wavelengths, you're looking deeper into the atmosphere and seeing the hotter temperatures. And then we had the first detection of Uranus.
Mm-hmm.
The 210 foot.
This is all down in Australia.
Yeah.
In the period
64 essentially.
To 66.
No.
Were you there for 2 years?
All in
65. I left. It was a little bit less than two, actually. I left in the spring of 65.
Let me ask about those first couple years on the Parkes dish. Did everything go smoothly as soon as the dish was built?
Well, it's Mark Price you want to talk to about the first year. I got there when things were pretty well smoothed out.
Was Bracewell's visit behind you when you got
there? The stories weren't.
You know that story.
I've heard of that. Yeah. Yes. I haven't checked the actual logbook. I'm told that you can actually look there to this
day. That's right.
It's a lot of fun.
No, the visitor's book.
The visitor's book.
Well, an interesting thing connected with the first observations was...
Hay didn't dare put that one in his book.
Bolton tried to make a map of Fornax. This is when the telescope was structurally complete, could be driven, but the equatorial wasn't running yet. So it could only be run in Altaz coordinates. And he said, he was interested in Fornax A, which is, you know, a great big source. And he sat down, you know, longhand, even without HP 35, and worked out, you know, the altitude and azimuth directions and whatnot to do scans across it. And did these scans. But then when he tried to tie them together, they just wouldn't fit. And, you know, after a few days or weeks, whatever it was, he gave up. I mean, he just couldn't get it to fit, figured out he hadn't gotten the coordinates right. I think he's just going to have to wait until the master equatorial gets in. And the reason he couldn't get it to fit was that he was using this Altaz dish with fixed polarization, working his way across the sky and was rotating, and the thing is 30 or 40% polarized.
When was this realized?
Well, it wasn't realized until after the Centaurus stuff. Then after he went back and did it properly, there's a high polarization. One of those things that was there.
You could really see how that could happen, yeah.
But Mark was involved with a lot of the early measurements and the discovery of Faraday rotation and everything.
I see. Was Mark there as a postdoc?
Yeah. No, he's a graduate student.
Oh, he's a graduate student.
Well, I've talked to Frank Gardner also, of course.
Oh, yes.
But see, Mark, well, there was this business with Bracewell, and then they all went away to fight about it, left Mark there. It was over an Easter holiday or something.
I see.
As he tells the story, actually, that early stuff was done at 11 centimeters, and there was a 20 centimeter receiver on the telescope. So he went out and did some of these sources at 20 centimeters. He got a different position angle. Couldn't understand that. Went back and looked at some physics book or something and trying to learn about polarization, ran across Faraday rotation and decided that's what it was. And then went and did another frequency, and sure enough, it was. Sort of in a weekend while everybody else was away.
Great.
Discovered Faraday rotation.
Lovely.
Let's see, during these times, you drop out of the mainstream for a couple of years, is that correct?
No, only one year, I guess.
In Canada.
That's right. I finished my PhD in 63, I guess about the same time you did, July 63. And so then, of course, one could then get any number of jobs. And I was offered a number of jobs without applying for them. And I took one that started with a year leave of absence and half salary. And I went to study philosophy for a year, which was always my ambition.
I see.
Where was that?
In Amsterdam.
Oh, that's right.
So I didn't lose touch with astronomy then. I kept up the literature, and I visited the Amsterdam Observatory and Leiden Observatory.
Mm-hmm.
Gave colloquy there, and I got to know Wurtz and Walcher sort of personally, and I'd met Vanderhoest already, because Vanderhoest was on leave at the Astros Institute at the time of the Zero Effect Symposium that we just discussed.
Oh, I see.
So I'd met him there, and there had always been supplies because they said there's this name, H. Mandelan, and I spelled it in the normal Dutch way rather than with, you know, the anglicized way. In monthly notices, they'd never heard of me. That's peculiar. Right. An astronomer with a Dutch name, and we'd never heard of him publishing in monthly notices. So they thought it was interesting. Anyway, so then after a year, I went back to Canada on this job that I'd accepted beforehand. And I spent, a summer at Algonquin, no, in Ottawa with the group. And
I see.
Then we went to Algonquin Park. But I spent two summers here, 66 and 67. And then at the end of 67, when was München? That was in 66, the ERSI thing in Munich. Did you go to that?
No, I didn't go to that.
I went to that.
66, that's right.
That was just after I'd written that little note in Nature on the variable, extragalactic variable sources. And 67 I was here, and as I came, the ARP paper came out. So I thought, Jeepers, if he's right, we have to start a whole, we have to do something completely different. So there's no point in me doing any problems unless I've convinced myself that ARP is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sat down and I convinced myself that ARP is wrong. And I was completely open-minded about it. When I came here and read the paper, it seemed so plausible. I thought, probably the guy is right, so I'll be wasting my time unless I can satisfy myself that he's right or not. And I convinced myself he was wrong, and I walked into Dave Heaston's office one day and said, ARP's completely wrong. Jeepers, let's hear about it, Dave says. He was rather interested. Dave had just been out to a trip to Harvard or something. Everybody was talking about this ARP paper in the May 5 issue, I think, of the NPJ. So I convinced Dave, and Dave said, you better write that up. So then we improved things a bit, and Frank Bash wrote a computer program, and Bash and I wrote that paper.
I see, this paper, I'm not familiar with this. What is it? Who are
the
authors?
A paper that shows how the ARP effect of pairing can arise in a selection effect, because you show only what you find and not what you've looked for where you've not found it.
Right.
So it's really a confusion of a priori and a posteriori probabilities. And we verified him empirically by generating phony ARP catalogs.
I see.
And you find it here. In fact, John Bacall has taken this paper over in that recently published debate between him and ARP.
I see, it's in that collection.
He's reprinted it there, yes.
Hmm. And who are the authors again?
Frank Bash and myself, Pendelan and Bash. Frank Bash was here. Yeah, so that's what I did here. And then Blau offered me a job in Groningen, and Ort offered me a job in Leiden. And although the job in Groningen was an electorat, and the one in Leiden was not, I went to Leiden because I sort of thought the prospect of working with Ort was rather nice.
This is 67.
Yes, and my wife wanted to go back to Holland. That's why I was looking for jobs in Holland in the first place. I didn't. I was only faintly aware that they were building some radio telescope.
Oh, I see. That wasn't part of your motivation.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I didn't want to go back.
I see.
And I always thought that we'd go back to Canada or the U.S. I thought I could never get used again to the Dutch way of life. But then I enjoyed it, and I rolled into Westerbork in Holland.
Hmm.
And I finally even got a chair when Ort retired, which I never dreamt about. And that was certainly not the reason for going back to Holland. I wasn't even aware how old Ort was.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff after this point, but like I said, I don't know if I mentioned you. I'm cutting it off at about 65 or so, because it just gets out of hand.
Oh, yeah.
But there is one, I'm making a couple of interesting incursions like pulsars, but I'd like to ask you about your ideas at the beginning of VLBI. You were in on the American end, weren't you?
Yeah. That came out over a pitcher of beer. It's probably not surprising. It's continued over pitchers of beer. The American project, the Canadian stuff, I think, went back a fair number of years.
I have talked to John Galt,
right?
So he's told me his version.
Yes, yeah. But we, I mean, nothing was done in the U.S. And it was the summer meeting of the AAS in '65 in Ann Arbor.
And yeah, I was there.
From me? Were you?
Yes.
Yeah. And I guess you're just talking. It was Marshall Cohen and I, and I don't remember who else, at a big table. Lots of pictures of beer, and we got to talking about it. And
was it Alan Yen there?
No. As I say, it was quite independent of the Canadian project. In fact, we didn't know. Well, we first found out about that during that winter. But a lot of people, I think, had thought about this independently earlier, many years earlier. As early as 1950. Or 52, the Hanbury Brown. I mean, that's what the Hanbury Brown interferometer was invented for. I mean, they thought that radio sources were stellar, and you needed transatlantic dimensions to resolve it.
Right.
And that's where he developed the intensity. I mean, they had no way of keeping coherence then, So they developed the intensity interferometer, and the concept of taking tape recorders